Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes here on News Talk 580 KMJ. A very interesting show, I think, we have set for you today with another World War II veteran. And each week when we talk to these veterans, I like to find out what we'd be missing if they had been one of the 400,000 Americans who didn't make it back from World War II, if something had happened along the way that had changed the course of their life. And this week, I've been talking to our guest a little bit before we've gone on air here, and I think it is very safe to say that the track that is in the Save Mart Center right now, that the Run for the Dream meet will be held on tomorrow, would not be there without every twist and turn of this man's life, and particularly his service during World War II. So we welcome to the show Fred Arnold today. Fred, thanks for being here.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Fred's got his orange jacket on today.
Yeah, that was my 84 Olympic jacket.
He was born in Tennessee, but it's not a Tennessee Vols jacket. He served as the head pole vault official in the 1984 Olympics, and it is his benevolence that has provided the nearly $1 million indoor track that is being assembled right now at the Save Mart Center.
Yep, that's right. Bob Fraley is looking after that, and I'm just lucky because when I came to from Tennessee to California, I rode a freight train.
and he didn't have a ticket.
Oh, no, I didn't need a ticket. I rode a freight train. I came across from Yuma, Arizona, and I was sitting right out on a bunch of pipe that was coming from Birmingham, Alabama, to come out here. And, you know, the sun was just beautiful. And so I must have sunburned five layers deep. I was about a week or more before my lips quit peeling and my arms quit peeling.
So your skin was the color of your jacket now.
Yeah, that's right. Because you see, being light-skinned, I sunburn very easily. And so I sure did cook down there. I never have liked Palm Springs.
Fresno's a lot better, right?
Yeah, it is. It is. And I had a lot of fun here at Fresno because I built over at Lindsay. And we built a lot of the houses when they were putting that big canal, the Bryant Kern Canal and so forth. Peter Kiewit was the major contractor on there, and I was building the houses. As about every 20 miles, we'd build houses for the engineers. Over the Touts Hill was where the first bunch that I built. And
You've been a fan of the West and California for a long
sure,
time.
Yeah, sure. That's the Lindsay Ripe Olive Center over there. You
know? I know it well. I know it well.
And it's...
Well, I want to take you back to before you started this building thing, because Fred is a very successful contractor, retired now from that, and now he spends his time at a lot of track meets, including the Run for the Dream meet tomorrow.
Right, right, right.
And as I mentioned, he donated the complete cost of that indoor track. But I want to get back to how this is all possible, and we're going to go way back. I know that your father died when you were very young.
Yeah.
Your mother died when you were 12.
Yeah, right. That's correct.
And you get done with...
I don't even remember him. He he was a Methodist minister, and I was born in Baxter, Tennessee, where they had a church name for him up there.
Right.
Or still do, I guess. Arnold's Chapel, I think is what it's called.
And once you left Tennessee... You rode the rails, did a little hoboing?
Oh, yeah, I did a lot of hoboing. That was a lot of fun. Well, I was going to Texas A&M, where my uncle, Dr. Fred Arnold, was a professor of agricultural economics. And well, when I got out to California, I changed. I went up to San Francisco, and back in those days, they had a World's Fair in San Francisco, and they had one in New York. And the feature attraction in San Francisco was Sally Sanford. And the feature attraction in New York was Billy Rose. And the story goes that when Billy Rose, Sally ran.
Which is how she ended up in San Francisco.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And I went out, and they wouldn't let me go in and see Sally Ran. But I, you know, I kept sneaking under the tent, and they kept throwing me out. And so then I went down and rode a freight train it had to be going east because the ocean, you know, was west.
Mm-hmm.
And I ended up up in Portland, Oregon. And but as I went through Santa Rosa, I went into this house, and I heard everybody just laughing and giggling and so forth. And I didn't have the slightest idea what it was. And later when I met some of these guys, they asked me, "Don't you know what that was?" And I said, "No, well, that was a cat house."
Little did you know. No. Probably a good thing you didn't know at the time.
Well, no. But, you know, they were having fun, so what the hell.
Tell me about how you ended up in the service. Now, I know before you actually ended up in the service, you had some exposure to aviation and a real pioneer in aviation.
Yeah, well, Jim Carroll was the founder of the variable pitch propeller. That's what they used before jets.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked with him on that. And he took it back to Akron, Ohio, and it was run to destruction because that's what you had to do. Before you could get them certified, you had to run them constantly for 10 hours. And one time I know somebody flew a little model airplane in the back of it. We had about 8 hours on it and, of course, shattered it all to pieces. So we had to make another one. But I was a very good carver, so I carved most of the props. I was the best carver they had.
Where did those props end up?
Well, they ended up on small planes. We built them up as anywhere from 40 horsepower up to 250 horsepower, like 65, 75, 125, and so forth. And they were all what we call fixed sticks. Means they didn't vary. But now Carroll eventually, he made a variable pitch, and he was very clever. You pull it back, and it rotates, and, you know, one goes one way and one goes another.
Right.
Now, the big key is how do you get the darn thing in there? And also, you had to make them light, and so we put micarta in the hubs, and then you could mill that down, and that was hard enough that these little needle bearings would rest against the shoulder and little ball bearings around the side, and then they would turn. Carroll was quite a guy. He was killed out at Johannesburg, California. I took him up in an AT-6, and he came down, and he was... his flaps didn't come down.
Mm.
And, of course, flaps are like the brakes.
Mm-hmm.
And so he tried to turn it, and it
rolled it,
flapped over, and I never have known for sure whether Carroll, you know, broke his neck or hit the dashboard. But anyway, we buried him out there at Johannesburg, and they were supposed to use the propeller off of the airplane as his gravestone, you know. I don't know whether they did or not, because those desert rats, they're kind of funny. As soon as anybody's gone, they rush in and rob the thing.
Mm.
And what I really wanted to do was get those, patents.
For the propellers?
Yeah, because they were basic patents. They controlled hydraulic, mechanical, and electrical. And, of course, that's all the motions they are, and that's what they are. But I didn't get to it, but Carroll then made a dry washer, because he was always looking for gold. And Northrop made a great big wheel for him, and you'd spin that thing, and the oil would, and then of course you would save the you'd save the black ore, and then melt it down and get what little gold there was in it.
So he was a man of many talents. He's gold mining here. He's an aviation pioneer. And I understand that's probably... Now, here you are helping him make these propellers. You're seeing how airplanes work. And somewhere along the line, he decided, you know, I think it'd be fun to fly those, maybe for the Army.
Yeah, that's true. You see, being as I worked with Carroll, I was always interested in aviation. And... I washed out air sickness first 3 days, I got so damn sick, couldn't walk away from the airplane. But after that, I got all right. But I found out that they have to wash out about half of them anyway.
Absolutely.
Because 150, then it goes to 75 and so forth. And so if they don't wash them out, they got to get rid of them someplace.
They don't have enough planes for everybody.
That's true.
Well, we need to catch a little commercial break here. When we come back, we'll talk about what you did do in an airplane for the Army during World War II and how all of his experiences and really what seemed at the time to be a very rough turn in his service turned into to be a blessing in disguise and led us to where we are today. You're listening to Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
The world's greatest athletes invade the Save Mart Center on January 21st. Run for the Dream is a one-day world-class indoor track and field meet. Professional athletes from the Visa Championship Series will be here to compete in a first-ever team sport event. It's USA versus the world. The best athletes from around the globe are ready to set records and blaze the new indoor track. Run for the Dream, a day-long track and field event like no other on January 21st. Tickets are available through Ticketmaster and the Save Mart Center box office.
This is Hometown Heroes. Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. You just heard that advertisement for the Run for the Dream tomorrow at the Save Mart Center. Get out there and support what is a great event, a growing event, and one that really might be a national exposure kind of event as it grows throughout the years. And one of the men making that possible, the man who is the reason that there's a brand new state-of-the-art indoor track being assembled right now in the Save Mart Center, Fred Arnold is with us. He's a World War II veteran, 86 years old. And we talked about a little of his adventures before he ended up in the service. His time riding the rails, hoboing it for a little while.
and
don't go around saying that anymore.
No, well, I don't mind. I'm very pleased because most people don't even know what a hobo is.
That's right. And I'm sure those experiences had a lot to do with the way you've lived the rest of the way.
I had a... Well, I saw every state in the Union, and I saw a lot of Cuba, Canada, Alaska, and... Riding the rails was, you know, a lot of fun. You didn't have to worry about buying a ticket. When I came through Yuma, Arizona, and cantaloupe season was on, and, of course, we filled up on cantaloupe and took as many with us as we could. And I was riding on those pipes coming across by Palm Springs, and it was hot. And, of course, I got sunburned.
Right, as orange as your jacket.
Yeah, right. I sure did.
I want to hear about when you put on a different kind of uniform. How long after Pearl Harbor was it that you decided you were going in?
I think it was Pearl Harbor was the 7th of December. I think mine was around the 22nd or 3rd, something like that, of April the next year.
So it wasn't too long, less than 6 months.
No.
And you wanted to be a pilot.
Yeah, right.
That didn't work out, but you still got to do a little flying. Tell us what your role was there.
Well, I got washed out because of air sickness.
Right.
And then went to Amarillo, Texas, and started to be a gunner. And I was lucky enough to meet this young lady that I was dating, and she told me where I was going. My next 5 bases, because I would go and help this guy work on airplane propellers, and I was late one day getting to the little old class, you know, and so I told him, he said I was late. I said, well, I was helping these guys. You don't do that, he says. Well, I said, and anyway, he says, you're not going to whatever the next base was. Well, I knew he didn't have any say-so, because this young lady...
You already knew where you were headed.
She told me I was going, and I went to every one of them except Denver. At Denver, they brought back a bunch of these young pilots, and they made them gunners. And thank goodness we had the squadron commander with us when I was in Cuba, because our plane caught on fire... And I remember looking down at those palm trees, wondering which one's going to break up first, the palm trees or us.
So you're up in a B-17.
I am.
You're the top gunner.
Yep.
And your plane's on fire.
On a 17.
Your side gunner on...
Yeah,
okay.
Top gunner on... side gunner on 29, top gunner on 17.
So here you are up in a B-17.
Yep.
And it's on fire.
Right. And
is the engine on fire, or what was on fire?
Well, it turns out the booster pumps, they put them on when takeoff to give the plane a little more fuel,
mm-hmm.
and then at 10,000 feet to cut them on again. Well, we, pulled up because our guns were sticking out every direction, and if we'd hit the ground, we'd have cartwheeled, you know. So he pulled up, and at 10,000 feet, he cut him back on again. And so the fire caught on again. So we flew for 15 hours on oxygen. And, man, that really does make your throat dry.
Wow.
But anyway, we made it back safe. That plane was kind of a jinx plane. It didn't make it back. It landed in a cornfield in Missouri. And when we were coming back from one of our runs, I don't know where it was now. But anyway...
Were you on it when it landed in a cornfield?
No, I wasn't on that one.
But you believed it when they told you.
Well, I know it went that one, you know, because it didn't make it back to Salina, Kansas, where we were stationed. So it had to go down. And
you fully expected, here you are, this is part of the 8th Air Force, and people that know the history know where the 8th Air Force ended up in Europe.
Yep.
You would have been part of the Normandy invasion.
I sure would have. And the Normandy Beach landing, or the Battle of the Bulge, one or the other, or both.
So you survived this plane on fire in training. You probably should have been heading over to Europe for the most intense fighting
time. That's correct.
But something else happened to you that changed your fate.
Well, that truck ran over me down at Van Horn, Texas.
How did that happen?
Well, I was going down the road, and I was driving. I'd just been driving a few minutes, and it's Saturday, and three of us were driving, and we hadn't even had a beer. Because the GI usually will have a beer on Saturday, but we didn't. We had some lemonade instead, and we got off down there about Van Horn, and I just had time to tell my buddies, we're going to hit, I can't miss him. He's right in the middle of the road.
This is a big, huge tanker truck coming at you.
Oh, tanker truck, and I went right straight out through the windshield with my car, and the car went rolling down the road and landed right in the middle of my hip and split my hip in a couple of places, skinned up my hands. They probably still got scars on them, I don't know. Anyway, and broke a few ribs and a few things like that. But it probably saved my life because I'd have been in the Normandy Beach landing and in that Battle of the Bulge, you know. That was terrible. We lost a lot of people in the Battle of the Bulge.
Mm-hmm.
The Belgians are still very, happy about Americans because of the fact the Germans had just clobbered them, you know, and Russia was coming the other way.
We've had quite a few Bulge survivors on this program, and my 91-year-old grandfather, who I was visiting with earlier today, got a Silver Star and a Bronze Star over there. But you missed out on that because of this horrible accident.
Yeah.
I'm sure you weren't thinking at the time, hey, this is the greatest thing that ever happened.
No, I didn't. I just, what I was thinking about was that I'm not going to go on with my buddies because you make good friends when you're in there.
Mm-hmm.
It's a team effort, and you get to where you look after each other, you know. And Andy Jesko, in particular, the tail gunner, he was a great big Polack from Lorain, Ohio. Weighed about 220 pounds, about 6'2". And he was my buddy. When I'd go into town, I would...
Good buddy to have.
I'd hang around with him because I know nobody would pick on me. Like one time we didn't salute there in Omaha, and this colonel was gonna, you know, immediately demote me. But then he finally decided to let us go. And I said to Andy, why don't we go around and whoop up on him? Well, we decided, oh, to hell with it. We're too busy going out to the Blackstone Hotel where we had a great time out there.
I'm glad that Andy's better judgment kicked in there
for
you.
Yeah, me too.
Otherwise, we might not be having this conversation right
Andy
now.
Andy was from Lorain, Ohio, and God rest his soul. He died a few years ago with a massive heart attack. But he was my buddy. In fact, he taught me to play golf because he could hit that damn ball like a bullet, you know. And his brother played for Paul Brown on the Great Lakes Naval Training Center football team up there, and he told all of them that he was going to start a professional team after the war was over.
And he sure did.
And he did. And, you know, the Cleveland Browns were one of the better teams in the whole league.
He was one of the greatest coaches ever.
Yeah,
absolutely.
He sure was.
Now, let me talk about what happened to you after you got injured. We'll get to a commercial here in a few minutes. So these are some pretty severe injuries. I mean, that you described that wreck pretty matter-of-factly, but that was pretty serious. You could have been killed there.
Oh, yeah.
And what did the Army have you do while you were recuperating?
Well, they took me to Fort Bliss, and I had my own travel papers. And so normally, before they let you go back to duty, you march 5 miles with a full pack and then 10 and 15 up to 25.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to the commanding officer, I don't march that far in regular duty. I only have to march out to the airplane.
Mm-hmm.
And so they couldn't hold me, you know, so they let me go. I got on a train.
They actually bought that, huh? You talked them into that?
Yeah.
You must be a persuasive guy.
I guess so. And I went on down to New Orleans where I wanted to stay, and I was pretty kind of, you know, a little bit woozy into New Orleans. And then that's where I first saw Russians. From New Orleans over to Jacksonville, some Russians had come across there. And by this time, we were friends with the Russians. And they rode and went along with us. And I thought, man, those woolly uniforms, how in the world do they stand those woolly uniforms? But, you know, they used to them, and so they did.
Mm-hmm.
And we taught them to play cards. And needless to say, we played cards better than they do.
Well, of course, if you taught them. I'm sure you taught them the right way.
We took quite a bit of their money. But they were very nice people. I went on over to Jacksonville, Florida, and on down to Fort Myers, where I was stationed. I got there, and they didn't even know I was coming. And I looked on the bulletin board out there, and what do you know? I'm stationed to go to Victorville. And I thought, oh, boy, I'm going to...
You're on the wrong side of the country.
Yeah. So I go out to Victorville. Turns out that they were just stopping me there while sending me over to Las Vegas. So here I am back in Las Vegas again, where I was stationed three different times. And a lot of the generals would like to come to Vegas because that's where they could come up there. Because that was a wide-open town, man, I tell you. Plenty of girls and plenty of gambling, plenty of everything. Anyway, they would come and they would make a big fast trip, you know, around out there where we were training, heading right back out to the Trocadero, one of those nightclubs, you know, where they hung out. But anyway...
And while you were there in Victorville, I understand you had some KP duty. You had to work in the mess hall a little bit.
Oh, yeah, I did. I did my share of it, although I didn't care much for that. So I went over and I laid down in a place and I actually went to a movie. And so it's time to go back to work. And where have you been? I've been here all the time. And so they were going to court-martial me because they thought I'd run off. But they couldn't figure
out... Maybe because you had.
They couldn't figure out anything against me, so they didn't do anything. So I knew that if they did anything, they couldn't ship me out on B-29s. And if they did, I was on B-17s, which I told them, that's where I want to stay anyway.
Mm.
And so I told them, they eventually told me, you know, you don't have to say a word. because anything you say can be held against you. And so they started asking me questions. And so I said, you said I didn't have to say a word. And he said, yeah. I said, then I refused to make a statement. And so they kept on, you know, saying things, thinking I'd correct them. But I didn't correct them.
Didn't fall for it.
I just didn't make a statement. And, of course, they did ship me out on B-29s. And I go down to Salina, Kansas, and on up to Kearney, Nebraska, and got my new airplane. And like I said, we headed for Japan, except it dropped that atomic bomb, and I turned around and went back.
So the injury, the automobile accident, first time kept you from ending up in Europe.
That's right.
The end of the war keeps you from going to Japan, so you dodged a couple bullets there.
That's right.
And in between, I'm talking about this KP duty in Victorville, and the reason I harp on that is because that very mess hall that you were stuck serving in, you ended up remodeling years later as part of the business that I understand was somewhat inspired by what you observed and what you saw.
Yeah, that's right. You see, I knew we were going to be a military nation, either fighting or defending ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought, well, somebody's got to build it. Might as well be me. And so I would bid a job, and then I think about five jobs I bid, and I got four of them. And you add them all up together, and you make pretty good money. One of them was an obstacle course, and this one lieutenant came over, wanted to know, how did you know how to build that? And I said, well, I got some blueprints right here. And he says, I've been looking for something like that. I got to build an obstacle course where it was he was stationed. So I let him have the plans, and we built the obstacle course. And I made good money, and I did a couple of mess halls, and then I remodeled several of the wards over there. And, you know, various things like that.
Do you think you would have had the knowledge, the insight, the expertise in that area, and known what you were going for, what to target, and how to do it, if you hadn't have had all that time in the service and been exposed to what you'd been exposed to?
Well, the service certainly helped. You know what I mean? Now, what I would have done otherwise, I don't know. Because the big thing, you see, I never did want to work for anybody else. And I didn't work for anybody else. Even when I was going to college, I had all these guys down there. And I thought to myself, what are they going to do when they get out of school? They got to work for somebody. So I said, I'll just get my license and hire them. And that's exactly what I did. I got my license, and I hired most of them, you know. And then I built all over the country. I built at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, Warner Robins, Georgia. I built at Centerville Beach up in Northern California.
So there's military buildings all over this country,
yeah,
that you had a hand in.
And San Diego, I built a lot of stuff. Mess halls. I built a racquetball court. And I remodeled some of those buildings in those great big bowstring hangars they got over there on Treasure Island.
Mm-hmm.
I remodeled some of them also.
Well, we need to catch another commercial here. When we come back, we'll talk more about the latest thing that you've had a hand in constructing that's being put together right now at the Save Mart Center. That's that brand new indoor track that the Run for the Dream meet will be run on tomorrow. We'll have more Hometown Heroes straight ahead on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Lattler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
We continue now with Fred Arnold, an 86-year-old World War II veteran. You heard about some of the trouble that he caused in his younger years, almost getting himself court-martialed. Now we're going to talk more about some of the tremendously good things that he's contributed to our society and to here in our valley in particular. A lot of people may have seen him over the years at the Clovis Street Vault with Coach Bob Fraley. And once Coach Fraley got this dream of the Run for the Dream meet off the ground, had the first one 2 years ago, at that point, Fred made a very big announcement and a very generous donation in honor of his late wife, Madeline. First, Fred, tell me how you got to know Coach Fraley and why it is that you've become a big enough fan of his and have enough trust in him to give these kind of gifts.
Well, I knew Bob Fraley's son, you know,
when Doug was vaulting?
Yeah, Doug, and he beat Bob Segrin's son down in the Coliseum one time. And he's the first one that jumped 18-11, and that's when he was, I'm not sure he might still even in high school. But that record stood for years and years, and finally, about three people beat it all at the same time.
That's how it goes in pole vaulting.
Yeah, you know.
And I should say that once upon a time, way back in your younger years, you tried doing it Dutch Warmerdam style on a bamboo
pole,
right?
Yeah, and I got out in the middle of the creek and hit right in the middle of the creek. But, you know, the pole vault started by the Irish, you know, fording these rivers, trying to get away from the British, I guess, trying to... And so they use these bamboo poles and they vault over and...
There was actually a reason to throw yourself into the air,
yeah,
other than clearing the bar.
Well, you know, necessity breeds a lot of reasons why we do things, you know. I mean,
the mother of invention.
If you run fast enough, well, you can get away. Otherwise, you can't.
That's right. And that's where our track meets come from, I guess.
Yep.
So you're a pole vault official for years and years,
yep.
and you're wearing the jacket from the 1984 Olympics,
yeah,
where you
I'm
were the head pole vault
jacket,
official.
I'll tell you.
And through pole vault, because Coach Fraley had his son vaulting and has continued to be the ambassador for the sport,
right.
You've developed this really good relationship over the years.
I have, and I got my own lifters to get the crossbar back up there.
Right.
Made out of stainless steel. And they won't break.
You have a patent on those?
No.
Maybe you should.
Yeah, maybe I should, but I just hope I can show people, you know, something good. And the way I got them made, and they're, you know, curved where you can reach right out there and get the crossbar and twist it and pull it back, and you don't have to jump on a pit and get it. And that curve... It doesn't get caught up, and you put it up there and right in the notch and pull it back. It's fast.
Because nobody wants an official wasting their time when they're trying to see the ladies and guys vault on that bar.
Steve Chappell gave me these poles. They're ladies' poles. They're very light, but they're long enough to get the pole, the bar back up there. And that stainless steel hook that I got on there, you know, is good enough to hold them up there. It just speeds up the game. I usually keep a score of how many people we get over, you know, per hour.
Mm-hmm.
And we get over about one a minute, you know, everything, even moving the crossbar up, we get over.
So that's important to you. You're keeping track of yourself to make sure that you're not slowing down the pace.
That's exactly right. Mm. And these kids, you know, they know you. And I usually call them, you're number one, you're number two, you're number three. A lot of them use the old baseball term, you're in the hole, and so forth. Well, I don't like that. One, two, three. And in that way, you can point to somebody like that, hold up two fingers, and they know you're number two. And I say, get with it.
Mm-hmm.
And they're on the runway ready to go, and that really speeds it up. And the audience, they like that better, too, because they think that the pole vault drags out. Well, it does if you don't know how to run it, but if you know how to run it, it doesn't drag out. I mean, you're finished before everybody else, you know.
And these are pole vault meets and track in general is something that you and your wife shared a passion for and spent many a year doing. When was the moment for you that you decided, you know what, to honor Madeline, I'm going to give Fraley a brand new track that they can run this meet on?
You know, I really don't know when it was, but it's been some time ago because, see, she's only been dead about 3 years, and mm-hmm. so it was within the last 3 years I decided, you know, I had plenty of money to do it, and I couldn't think of a better thing to do as a memorial to my wife than her because, see, out at Mount Sac, she'd run one pit, and I'd run another one. And then at the, you know, Fresno relays, the same thing. She'd run one pit and I'd run another. And it's nice to, if your wife is working with you because, you know, you both share the same interest. And that's, That's very, very good. And I like that, and I hope I pass it on to other people that they'll realize that a good partner, you know, is worthwhile to have.
Amen. I don't want to touch too many emotions here, but and feel free to stop me if I step over the line here, but when you were down there earlier today, I understand you were at the Save Mart Center watching them begin to put this track together.
Right,
and
it's a beautiful track.
And you haven't seen it completely assembled yet, right? This will be the first time.
Yep.
Were you thinking about Madeline when you watched them do that?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, they got that name, Fred and Madeline Arnold Memorial Track. And I can't think of anything better to spend my money than for that. And Fraley, you know, he does a heck of a job. So I'm just very, very pleased to be able to do that, because you know, when you come here from Tennessee with practically no money riding a freight train, and you're able to accumulate enough to build that track, well, that's worthwhile, and I'm very pleased to do it.
We'll catch our final commercial break here. When we come back, I'll have you tell us what you see as the future for this run for the Dream Meet and what you think it's capable of becoming over the years. You're listening to Hometown Heroes today on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Now, more Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Time always goes by so quickly on this program. We come down the home stretch of Hometown Heroes this afternoon. It's been a pleasure visiting with Fred Arnold, whose generosity has provided that close to $1 million brand new state-of-the-art indoor track that is being assembled at the Save Mart Center as we speak. I think Bob Fraley and his crack team are putting the finishing touches on that right now. The meet, of course, is tomorrow at the Save Mart Center. The first event starts at 10:30, and they'll run all day long, well into the nighttime, and probably won't be done till almost 10 o'clock at night by the time they finish all those. And I think Coach Fraley is expecting that Fred, who's 86 years old, donated that track, that he's going to be sitting up in the stands and watching, but no, that's not true?
No. I'm going to be down on the floor. I like to meet all my buddies, you know, because I've known all of them. In fact, I officiated some of them's parents, you know, and now... Tracy O'Hara, I knew her parents, and Stacy Dragilla, I knew her, and I'm trying to think of the one.
So you're going to be down there with your pole putting the bar back on?
You darn tootin' I am.
So if you go to the Save Mart Center tomorrow, and I hope that you will, and this meet is going to involve high school kids, college competitors, and some of the best athletes in the world in that USA versus the world format. But keep your eyes open. You going to be wearing the orange jacket tomorrow?
Yeah, I sure will.
Look for that orange jacket on the floor, and you'll see Fred.
I'm very proud of that orange jacket.
You should be. It's got that 84 Olympic logo on it, because that's where you used it. That looks very nice.
Yeah.
Let me ask you what, obviously you believe in Coach Fraley and his dream of this meet becoming a national level event, and it is already with the Visa Championship Series coming through here. How significant do you think this is now, and how significant do you think it can become in the future?
Well, you see, the Melrose Games in New York, it's my understanding, I don't know this for sure, but they've lost their sponsor, and if they've lost their sponsor, they can't put it on.
And that for years has been the premier indoor event in the country.
Oh, yeah, that's the top one. Well, now, if they've lost their sponsor and they can't put it on, and I'm supporting this one out here, why, and so far I've got enough money to do it, and, you know, it draws interest and all that, so it keeps on building up. And I figure that with Fraley, I think maybe it cost him about $125,000 to put on a meet. Well, if I donate $100,000, that means he's only got $25,000 to come up with, and he can sell a lot more tickets than that. So I think it'll perpetuate itself, and we won't have any problem at all of keeping this going. And Fraley is one of the, you know, the best ones that I know to keep it going.
And you live in Southern California. Obviously, you know Fresno well because you've been up here so many times.
Right, yeah. I built over at Lindsay, you know.
Right.
I built part of the Frank Kern Canal and used to come up to Fresno and get my supplies and so forth. And I've always kind of liked Fresno, you know. It's a nice city.
Do you think that this meet is something that has the potential. You know, there's been a lot of talk here about we were supposed to have a golf course, that there was going to be a PGA Tour event, and that hasn't happened yet. Donald Trump wanted to bail it out, and that hasn't happened. Do you think that a meet like this, with the cause that it's for, with the type of athlete that it can attract, do you see that as something that can maybe grab attention for people like you living in Southern California? If you weren't involved in it already, you can say, wow, they've got something special going up in Fresno. Do you think it's that significant of a thing that can put Fresno on the map?
I certainly do, with somebody like Fraley, pushing it. Oh, yes, I think it will. Because, you see, the big thing is they don't have to concern themselves about running out of money. And too many of these others, even the Drake relays, I'm not sure they're doing all that well. Now, there are certain ones like Mount Sac, but they don't pay the people out there. And so...
And the reason they don't have to worry about running out of money is you're backing them up, huh?
I'm going to help them in all the money that they need. That's all. It's money well spent as far as I'm concerned.
Well, I know that Coach Fraley has thanked you, and a lot of people have, but I want to thank you for that as someone who lives here. Thank you for doing this for our community and on behalf of all our listeners. I think they would want to say the same thing, and they'd also want to thank you for your service in World War II, and we're glad you didn't have to go to Europe or Japan and that you're here today to tell us all these stories.
Me too. I'm glad I didn't go over there because I might not be here. Believe me, we lost a lot of good buddies over there. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people thought we shouldn't have dropped the atomic bomb. But Hirohito wouldn't give up, and so we had to drop it, that's all.
Saved a lot of lives.
I think it saved a lot of lives and shortened the war by at least 5 years.
And yours is one of the lives it might have saved.
Yeah, because those Japs, they wouldn't give up. You know, those kamikaze pilots and all that kind of stuff, they were fanatical, they wouldn't give up.
Let me ask you, we've just got a couple minutes left here. All your years of track and field, and obviously the 84 Olympics was one of the great days in American track and field, great events in American track and field history, and our good friend from Kingsburg, Rayford Johnson, carried the torch.
Yeah, I saw Rayford do that.
Yeah, you were right there in the Coliseum. Tell me, of all the athletes that you've come across over the years, is there one that stands out to you that was the most impressive, or the one that if you could choose to watch anyone compete, that would be the one person you wanted to watch compete?
Well, Doug Fraley would be one, but also Rayford Johnson was a damn good competitor too. And then that one, can't think of his name right now, that I think won the 100-yard dash. It's not Bob Segrin. It's another one.
How long ago?
Around about the 84 Olympics.
Carl Lewis won 100 meters.
Carl Lewis was an awfully good competitor, not only in the sprints, but the relays.
And the long jump?
And the long jump. He competed in about three or four different things and usually would take first place in all of them. He was just one of the best, that's all.
he matched Jesse Owens with the four golds.
Yeah.
Now, I know you never saw Jesse Owens one, right?
No. Well, now, we did the Owens when Jesse was living, this is many years ago, he put on a track meet for, just ordinary people.
Mm-hmm.
And I officiated in that. Usually it's the high jump. We didn't do the pole one. And after Jesse passed away, then his brother, who lived over in Pasadena, he carried on for the longest time. I don't think it's still going. But Jesse did, a heck of a job. And he used to come down to those buildings there on West Adams, and we'd sit around and talk. And they always thought that he was insulted by Hitler, and he said no. He wasn't invited to come there to do that. Hitler didn't have to come down and speak to him. So he didn't have any animosity towards him. In fact, I don't think he had any animosity towards anybody yet.
That's what I've heard. That's what I've heard.
A
great man.
Hell of a nice guy.
Well, I think we can say the same for you. It's been a pleasure having you here today. Unfortunately, we're running out of time. I know you've got a lot more stories, and we could sit here and talk for a while. But it's been a great pleasure and a grand thank you for your service to our country and your service to our valley here in putting this the great track on the floor at the Save Mart Center. I hope that all our listeners will go out there and say hello to the man in the orange jacket tomorrow.
Okay, thank you.
That's Fred Arnold. This has been Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.